20 years ago this month, commentator James Martin left a job in corporate America for the Society of Jesus, the Catholic religious order better known as the Jesuits. That means 20 years of poverty, obedience, and chastity. According to Martin, it's that last vow that most people find hardest to understand.
My friends and family all said the exact same thing. Are you out of your mind? People think that getting a call, as it's known, means hearing voices or seeing visions. But discovering your vocation is as simple as believing that God speaks to you through your desires. That's what happened to me. One night after a lousy day at work, I turned on the TV and stumbled on a documentary about a Trappist monk named Thomas Merton. He seemed so happy in the show. Suddenly, I knew that I wanted to be happy like that. I love being a Jesuit priest. Since entering the novitiate in 1988, I've worked with refugees in Nairobi, in a prison in Boston, with Mother Teresa's sisters in Jamaica, and even with street gang members in Chicago. Now, I know what you're thinking. What about the whole chastity thing? Do those sexual desires ever go away? Well, I'll tell you what one elderly Jesuit said when I asked him that question. He said, "Oh yeah, they go away. 10 minutes after you're dead." Chastity means finding ways of loving and being loved that don't include having sex. It also means having lots of friends with whom you can really share your innermost joys and sorrows. That may not work for you, but it does for me. And some of history's most loving people have been celibate. Francis of Assisi, Mother Teresa, and, oh yeah, Jesus of Nazareth. He was a pretty loving guy. Chastity is one way of loving many people deeply and freely. Life in a religious order isn't for everybody, but it's not supposed to be. Everyone has their own vocation, which flows from their desires and talents. Some people feel drawn to be lawyers or doctors or teachers or mothers or fathers. I like to think that these deep desires are God's dreams planted within us. And by following these desires, we fulfill God's dreams for the world. People still ask if I regret leaving the corporate world. And I have an easy answer. Nope. Life in the Jesuits fits me. It's far from perfect, but I couldn't imagine living any other way. After almost 20 years, I'm happy that God called me. I'm even happier that I answered.
James Martin is a Jesuit priest and author of A Jesuit Off-Broadway, Center Stage with Jesus, Judas, and Life's Big Questions.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Now a Wikipedia whodunit. John McCain picked Alaska Governor Sarah Palin as his vice presidential running mate today, but earlier this morning, just 15 minutes after rumor of her selection broke, a Wikipedia editor discovered something interesting. Yesterday, some 30 mostly favorable changes were made to Palin's Wikipedia biography. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
Here are the facts of the case. Starting at 8:10 in the morning on Thursday, someone started making changes, lots of them, to Sarah Palin's page. The changes, all from a single source, included the addition of a quotation calling Palin a politician of eye-popping integrity. The edits diminished a reference to Palin's participation in a beauty pageant and minimized a section about a controversy over whether Palin used her influence to get her ex-brother-in-law fired. Wikipedia normally allows anyone to edit its pages, so long as the result is considered neutral. But in this case, Justin Deal, the editor, decided to blow the whistle.
24 hours before she became the nominee for vice president of the United States on the Republican ticket, someone spent hours essentially rewriting the article in a way that I think comes across better in many ways, but in some cases much more favorable than it did just, 24 hours ago.
Since then, a Wikipedia administrator restricted who could alter her page.
I dug a little deeper, and that's when it became clear that this account had only ever been used to make these significant changes to a single article on a single candidate. In Wikipedia, that's usually a pretty big red flag.
The person making the changes seems to know a great deal about Palin's life, including that her family sometimes woke up at 3 a.m. to hunt moose. But right now, not much is known about the identity of the person making the changes, except that they use a screen name Young Trigg. Trigg is the name of Palin's infant son, although Deal says he doesn't know what to make of that, and the McCain campaign did not return calls requesting comment about the changes. Of course, burnishing online profiles is very common, especially in politics. 2 years ago, Wikipedia shut off Capitol Hill's access to editing functions after staffers started tweaking their boss's pages. Also, President George W. Bush's entry is indefinitely protected, except from elite Wikipedia editors. In Palin's case, Diehl says, it's good the changes were caught early.
If you Google for Sarah Palin, which I bet probably millions of Americans will be doing today, the first thing you find is her Wikipedia entry.
Passions run high in politics, and it's not unusual for people to fight for years over a simple phrase in an article on a controversial topic like abortion or evolution. Part of the problem, and maybe the appeal, is that anyone can submit suggestions on Wikipedia articles. Volunteer editors help referee these disputes, and Diehl points out that according to the rules of this open editorial model, directly making changes on yourself or someone you're close to is a no-no.
You should not edit an article if you potentially have a conflict of interest.
For the record, Diehl considers himself not eligible to edit Palin's page because he's written personal blogs saying McCain should pick her as his running mate. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The history of Los Angeles is rich with Roman Catholic tradition. The city has 103 streets named after Catholic saints: Santa Monica Boulevard, San Vicente Boulevard, Santa Catalina View. And one L.A. artist has taken it upon himself to travel every last one of them. He has spent 8 years exploring the saints and their namesake streets. He's also painting new portraits of the saints using the faces of contemporary Angelenos. Sky Road reports.
Back at the beginning of his project, J. Michael Walker started making portraits of homeless people living on San Julian Street in a part of downtown L.A. known as Skid Row. Walker marveled at the confluence of story and circumstance. San Julian is the patron saint of wanderers.
Here it is, the street that's named for him. It's where the wanderers gather and where clinics that serve the wanderers are located.
Walker was on Skid Row one day when he came across a woman named Giovanna, who had what he called an off-kilter beauty.
She also looked so young and fresh that she seemed to be totally out of place with this trodden-down, beaten-down place in the middle of Skid Row. I asked her if I could take her photograph, and she looked up and said, "I've been waiting for somebody to take a good photograph of me."
Giovanna had come to L.A. to become a star, but when she went to have her headshots done, the photographer asked her to undress for him. And every time she tried to pull herself up, something or someone else pushed her back down again. Just like Santa Ynez, one of the virgin martyrs killed for standing up for herself when asked to submit. Giovanna became Walker's new Santa Ynez.
The themes that animate history are themes that resonate in our lives all the time. Seeing these historical or legendary characters with the faces of people that you could pass on the street any day helps us to see it as something that's relevant to our lives.
In J. Michael Walker's exhibit at the Autry National Center, there's something different every way you look. Paintings, but also maps and old retablas and hand-colored engravings. But one black and white portrait stands out. A little girl has butterfly wings. The sun cries fat tears above her. "Good luck in heaven" is written in loopy script below. Her left hand rests on her heart. Her right hand holds what looks like a valentine. 9-year-old Stephanie Rigosa is an unofficial saint. She died October 8, 2000, after she was hit by a stray bullet while playing on her scooter outside her house. Walker was commissioned to create her portrait for her funeral. Stephanie's mother, Norma Rigosa, has mixed emotions about seeing the portrait. "When I enter and see her, I can sense sadness in her eyes," Rigosa says. "But I also feel happiness because I sense that she's with me." Saint Stephanie, Santa Monica, who's been adopted by a group of mothers with sons in prison, San Miguel, who weighs the souls of the dead. One of the museum guards loved that image so much, he asked Walker for permission to have it tattooed on his chest before he leaves for Iraq in October. Walker realizes these saints are part of everyday life for so many Angelenos. They're in our streets, on our walls, in our memories, receiving our hopes and dreams and prayers with open arms.
If you can find the sacred in the world around you, rather than in something that's distant and apart from you, then maybe you can be better integrated to the world you live in.
Walker has painted San Isidro, patron saint of day laborers, as a gardener. He stands with his rake in hand, denim shirt tucked in and sleeves all rolled up. The lines in his face are deep. Walker says when he went one morning to explore San Isidro Drive in Bel Air, the only people he saw were doing yard work. He stopped to talk to one of them.
I mentioned to him that it occurred to me that he was a San Isidro. And he kind of chuckled and nodded his head, I guess so. And I asked if he'd be willing to pose for me, and he assented.
It's the portrait of San Isidro that kids go to again and again when they come to see the exhibit, Walker says. He's strong but humble. He's a saint, but he could be their uncle or their grandfather, too. This painting and all of J. Michael Walker's other saint portraits are collected in his book, All the Saints of the City of the Angels. For NPR News, I'm Skye Rode.
And you can see some of J. Michael Walker's portraits and explore the streets of Los Angeles with an interactive map at our website, npr.org.
Now, from college football to another popular college sport, partying. The University of Florida in Gainesville is usually ranked among the top 50 schools in the country. Recently, though, it was singled out for another distinction, America's number one party school. As NPR's Greg Allen reports, that's a reputation University of Florida administrators want to put behind them.
It's a Monday night and the first day of school here in Gainesville, but the Swamp, a bar and restaurant just off campus, is busy. Outside on the patio, Kelly King is one of 20 young women there to celebrate a friend's 21st birthday party. I ask her about the University of Florida's ranking as the nation's top party school. Justified?
Not really. I mean, we like to have a good time, but there are other schools that do it harder than us. But
such as?
Florida State, for one.
Most students I talk to in Gainesville seem surprised their school had topped the ranking. But it's not as if the University of Florida is a stranger to the annual list. Princeton Review is a test prep and educational services company that ranks schools by a variety of criteria. UF has been on its party school list every year since it was first compiled 17 years ago. It's a ranking that's based on student surveys that cover several areas, including the amount of beer, hard liquor, and drugs used on campus, hours of study outside of the classroom, and the popularity of fraternities and sororities. Christina Weininger, a senior from Miami, says it's no coincidence that the school finally hit number one the year after it won national championships in football and basketball.
It's ironic, though, because last year they wanted to crack down, is what they said, and our president here really wanted to cut down everything, but I just think it's kind of ironic that we came back and improved our ratings as a top party school.
While UF students are generally amused that their school has hit the pinnacle in collegiate partying, University administrators have a different reaction.
It's unfortunate.
Patricia Tejas Irvin is vice president for student affairs at the University of Florida. She questions the validity of Princeton Review's survey.
Yes, we have a very good athletic program. There's no question about that. I also know that our students are very, very smart, so, you know, they may not have to study so much. But I also know that it's a self-select population that actually fills this survey out.
University President Bernie Matchin shares Tejas Irvin's skepticism. It's hard for him not to take the number one party school ranking personally. Shortly after arriving at the university 4 years ago, a series of student deaths led him to make it his mission to reduce binge drinking and excessive partying on campus. The university instituted a campaign to change student behavior and attitudes toward alcohol. All incoming freshmen must now take a course on alcohol awareness. The school banned alcohol ads at campus events and canceled a show on the campus radio station that featured a live drinking segment. Matchin believes these efforts have had a positive impact.
Fewer students indicate that they participate in binge drinking. There are fewer cases referred to the student judicial system for adjudication that have to do with alcohol. And hopefully, this is a positive sign, there are fewer alcohol-related transports to our emergency rooms.
However, the results are uneven. Drunk driving arrests on campus were up last year. And on a campus with more than 50,000 students, fatal traffic accidents related to alcohol use are not uncommon. Matchin seems resigned to his image on campus as something of a party pooper. He's now overseeing an effort to rewrite and tighten the school's conduct code to clarify infractions and the penalties associated with underage drinking and alcohol abuse. Matchin says his crusade is not for abstinence, but to teach students to be responsible in all aspects of their lives, including alcohol. Like it or not, he says, alcohol and drinking are an inextricable part of student life at the University of Florida.
Kids go away. Being a small town, all of our kids are packed in, they live near each other, they go to school together, and they party together. And I think that's a wonderful environment in which to go to college. We just want them to be safe and go off and be happy and productive in their lives.
As a top 50 school where incoming freshmen have GPAs of 4.1 and SAT scores average 1,300, the University of Florida has a lot to be proud of. Now university officials are working to convince students that sun, national championships, and thousands of their closest friends don't make school a four-year-long cocktail party. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
And you can see a list of the top 20 party schools at our website, npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Democratic Convention was not the only political drama in Denver this week. After schoolyard arguments last year between young Clinton and Obama supporters, a teacher at Ebert Elementary School chose to teach the election in a new way. He realized that kids react to books much as they react to their favorite candidates. They like them because everyone else does, adding titles to their favorite lists even when they haven't read them. Out of that idea came an unusual concept. Youth Radio sent us this audio postcard.
This is Bridget Galati reporting from Denver, Colorado at Ebert Elementary from Greg Isaac's fourth grade class. Our class is having a book election during the Democratic National Convention. Our book election is an election where we stand behind our favorite book instead of our favorite candidate. And let's go meet some of my friends. First, we'll go to the Eggs group. It's a book by Jerry Spinelli. Hey, Creed, could you tell me what Eggs is about?
Really, it's just about a boy who goes on an adventure with a girl who can turn dead and alive.
Hey, Demetrius, do you have anything to say?
No, not much, but I just want to say that's the biggest group, and that's all.
Now, let's go to the next group. This is Warriors. Warriors is one of the smallest groups. It only has four people. And I'll let my friend Kieran explain to you a little bit more about our book.
Hi, it's Warriors is, I think it's a really great book. And it's filled with action and adventure, and it has lots of battles.
Now maybe we should talk to my friend Jake to tell us what it's like to be in one of the smaller groups and how we're going to maybe get people onto our team.
I don't know how we're going to do this because I think that I haven't read the book yet, any of the books, so I have sort of an idea from Anna about what the book is about. And
is it hard to be in a group that you barely even know anything about the book? And why are you even in this group if you barely even know anything about the book?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of different reasons I think I joined, and I just can't explain them.
Now we're going to talk to my friend Riley. She's an undecided, but let's see what she has to say.
Well, me and Annie, we were just going to make a group for a book called Coriander. So, yeah, pretty much.
Okay, there are two other groups, but there's no one here that we can really talk to about them. And the other two books are Harry Potter and Frindle. Now that you've met all the groups, I'll tell you a little bit about what we're doing. In the next week or two, we'll have some primaries and that sort of stuff. And in the next, probably in the most a month, the fourth grade will decide on the fourth grade president, book president. I'm signing off. We're going on to a next period. Bridget Galati here. Bye.
Bridget's story was produced by Youth Radio.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. 3 years ago today, Hurricane Katrina made landfall along the Gulf Coast. And today, we'll visit one of the worst-hit areas, Louisiana's St. Bernard Parish. About half of the people who lived there have come back.
St. Bernard sits just to the east of New Orleans. It's surrounded by water, the water that's been its lifeblood for fishing, but also its undoing. When Katrina hit, 95% of the parish was flooded under anywhere from 8 to 21 feet of water. Because of the more visible trauma to New Orleans, St. Bernard was largely forgotten. Last week, I drove through what's left of the parish with a man who's trying to make sure we remember, writer Ken Wells.
Now, this is one of the houses that was brought back after the storm. This house is 100 years old. And you see they jacked it up on those 17-foot pilings. It had been actually picked up and moved from the foundation by the storm.
It's just hovering there.
Ken Wells covered Katrina for the Wall Street Journal, got to St. Bernard Parish 9 days after the storm. FEMA had just arrived. He says the small fishing villages looked like they had been carpet bombed. Ken Wells tells the story of those who rode out the storm here in his new book, The Good Pirates of the Forgotten Bayous. And he's brought us to meet one of those pirates, a shrimp boat captain named Ricky Robin.
I don't know when you're going to be coming off of this ship here. I hope y'all got y'all clothes with y'all. And my partner.
Hey, buddy.
Oh, my partner, boy, you did something, you.
Great to see you, man.
Every time I read that book, I start crying. I said, this man done got everything to the teeth.
Ricky Robin is on the deck of the Lil Rick. It's a 56-foot-long steel shrimp trawler that he built himself. He started welding it in high school shop class. Ricky has eyes the color of the sea. In blue jeans and white rubber shrimping boots, he's 5'6" of energy and muscle.
Come on this boat, because I got to go catch some shrimp.
Okay, great.
In his book, Ken Wells writes about how Ricky Robin rode out Katrina on this boat, a terrifying time, the storm way stronger than he expected. But he made it, saved his boat, and used that boat to save many people. We'll hear that story in a little bit, but first, we've got some shrimp to catch. Ricky Robin can see them, bright points of light on his sonar.
This is the shrimp we're looking at here. This is schools of shrimp. Nobody puts it that here but me.
Ricky Robin is trawling today in a shipping channel.
We're in the Mr. Go here.
The Mr. Go, the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet. During Katrina, the storm surge punched through long stretches of the earthen levees along the Mr. Go, flooding the parish. Ricky Robin's family roots here go back 250 years. His ancestors were here when this waterway was land.
This is actually was a swamp. We're going through a swamp. I'm working on top of where my grandfather's walked. They was hunting on this very spot, and I'm catching shrimp. You know, could you imagine?
Ricky Robin lets out his 50-foot net. He'll be trawling at 2 knots. One thing about Katrina, it's been really good for shrimping. Ricky says, after the blow, it wakes everything up. We trawl for a couple of hours, then it's time to pull in the haul. And it's a stunner. The net comes up bulging with shrimp as hungry porpoises swim alongside.
I would say I'm in them. I know I'm in them. I know they're going to be a little while, and they all belong to the little rig. Look like about 1,500 pounds of shrimp on the drag.
That's a sweet catch. After the shrimp are sorted and rinsed, they're put on ice in the hold. And I talk with Ricky Robin about what he went through during Katrina. He had tied down the Lil Rick in a canal. It's a 70-ton trawler, but it was getting tossed around wildly in winds gusting up to 140 miles an hour. At the height of the storm, Ricky climbed up on the rigging to lower the booms so the boat would be more stable.
Well, while I was up there, I was just fussing. Fussing and raising heck. Just fussing at that hurricane. I was furious, out of my mind, angry. I dropped them booms down and said, let it blow, 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 blow. And let me tell you, that she did. She blew, 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 blew.
Ricky Robin and other fishermen ended up rescuing many people flooded out of their homes, bringing them on board. Ricky poured coffee, heated up biscuits and gumbo for the survivors. He had the kids climb down below for safety, into the hold where he stores shrimp.
30, 40 people that slept on that boat that first night.
Right here.
Hundreds of people. Hundreds of people just lined up on the bayou floating on boats. Could you know, you look at the movie Titanic when all these people was crying. You know, that's disturbing to hear these people crying. Could you imagine hearing people crying for 4 or 5 days and never did it stop?
So Ricky had an idea. He got out his trumpet.
I played the horn to calm them down and make a little laugh come out of these poor people that was crying. I had them dancing for a little while there.
And this is what he played.
I get flashbacks now from the hurricane. I get bad flashbacks. Not bad flashbacks. I shake them off. My biggest flashback is thinking about my daddy. He committed suicide, put a rope on his neck, committed suicide 3 months after. I lose my daddy. You know, it's just one of them. It added to the more problem we already had.
Despite all this, the loss of so much all around him, despite that, or maybe because of that, Ricky Robin is proudly wearing a gray T-shirt that says, No Place Like Home, St. Bernard Parish. Writer Ken Wells grew up in Louisiana Bayou country, and he knows exactly what that means.
I remember being in New York City and having a reasonable conversation with someone who said, you know, they just need to relocate all those people and get them out of here. Why are these people living in a hurricane alley? Well, I was in San Francisco during the 1989 earthquake, and no one seriously suggested, well, you know, San Francisco sits on the San Andreas Fault. Let's move it to Modesto.
So Ricky Robin stays, but most of the fleet has gone.
Some of your best fishermen's the only ones left. Now's the time to start.
But the economics are lousy now, with diesel $4 a gallon and shrimp prices at rock bottom. In the 70s, they got about $6 or $7 a pound. Now, they get less than a quarter of that. The writer Ken Wells says Ricky Robin and the others who have come back to St. Bernard are fighting to save a way of life.
I mean, what a magnificent day. We trawl for 2 hours, he catches 1,500 pounds of shrimp, but he's going to go to the dock now and get $1.50 a pound. And where you and I live, those same shrimp are showing up in the supermarket for $16.50 a pound. Somebody's making money, but it's not the Gulf shrimper. And these, it's an endangered species. I mean, we're talking about...
The shrimper itself is a dangerous species.
That's right. And a culture that, in a strange way, it's knitted into the fabric of the landscape. I mean, you know, once it's gone, you can't put it back together again.
Half the people that was original from here are not here. The good people. You know, hard down family people's gone. Most of the people that's around here now, that they don't care about nothing. They don't want to help themselves. They're looking for handouts. And why look for handouts? Get your lead out your goddamn mask. Go throw that net in the water. Go catch you some shrimp. Go catch you some fish. Go catch you some crabs and put some money on the table. We fishermen, go. That's what we're supposed to do.
I talked to Ricky Robin by phone this morning. He's closely watching the new storm, Gustav, as it heads toward the Gulf Coast. His wife and her family will evacuate tomorrow. But Ricky is staying put on the Little Rick. He'll seek harbor tonight, ride out whatever comes. And after the storm, he says, I'll come out here and get these shrimp. On our website, you can see photos of our day on the Little Rick and read an excerpt from Ken Wells' book, The Good Pirates of the Forgotten Bayous. That's at npr.org.